Hello everybody. I'm Chris Gregory. Welcome to another episode of A Head Full of Ideas, a Bob Dylan podcast. Today we're going to be looking at the first track on 1978 Street Legal, Changing of the Guards, which is a long song full of very complex symbolism. I guess over the years a lot of people have listened to this and gone, well, that was pretty impressive, but what the hell was all that about? Well, this will hopefully be a helpful guide for you. This is called Pale Death Retreating, Symbolism, Metaphor and Metamorphosis in Changing of the Guards. Changing of the Guards, which opens 1978 Street Legal, is one of Bob Dylan's richest creations. Each line throws out another luminescent image, almost every one of which is open to symbolic interpretation. The song is one of Dylan's great epics, bearing comparison to Hard Rains Are Gonna Fall, Desolation Row, Visions of Johanna, Tangled Up in Blue, and Joker Man in terms of ambition. Like these songs, it marries the personal and the universal, seamlessly mixing poetic and colloquial language and showing us scenes in the poet's mind from a range of shifting perspectives. In some ways, it follows on from the cinematic songs on the previous album, Desire. But if this song is a movie, it is constructed almost entirely of jump cuts, throwing us from one scenario to another with reckless abandon. It is also, if performed in the right spirit, a great rock song, whose verses are linked by a very hummable riff, which works best if it is attacked. Dylan performed the song many times on the 1978 World Tour, backed by his big band, which included a saxophone player and female backing vocalists. Possibly inspired by the brilliant contemporary live shows of Bruce Springsteen and Bob Marley. The recording on the album is marred by slightly muddy production, but as Dylan develops the song throughout the tour, it builds and builds into one of his most powerful creations. By the time it reaches Charlotte, North Carolina on 10th of December, by consensus the greatest show of the year, he has turned it into a loud, heavy and triumphant wall of sound. There are also some worthwhile covers. Patti Smith does a good job, although her version is perhaps a little too reverential. The Gaslight Anthem and Frank Black, however, both less in awe of the lyrics, perhaps, treat the song as a delirious, kick-ass piece of rock and roll, building it up into a series of furious climaxes. The song presents a series of very powerful images linked with a dreamlike logic, in a way that foreshadows much later work like Ain't Talking or Key West. Like many of those later songs, it is focused partly on the endless struggle an artist has to go through in order to connect to his or her poetic muse. It also uses symbolism and shifting narrative perspectives to relate the story of a tangled relationship, much like the songs on Blood on the Tracks. At the same time, it speaks to universal concerns, almost as if it is a follow-up to The Hard Rains Are Gonna Fall, a parade of unforgettable visual images culminating in the poet surveying the world from a mountaintop and refusing to hide away underground in the face of the threat of Armageddon. Changing of the Guards is much more ambiguous, but equally apocalyptic in its implications. As the images it presents us with are so pointedly symbolic, it may be that every listener will divine a different meaning from the song, which is not a bad thing, of course. Dylan certainly seems to be communicating with us here on several levels at once. In a 1978 interview with Jonathan Cott, he commented that Changing of the Guards is 1,000 years old. Woody Guthrie said he just picked songs out of the air. That means they were already there and that he was just tuning into them. Changing of the Guards might be a song that might have been there for thousands of years, sailing round in the mist, and one day I'll just turn to it. Well, that's Bob for you. You can believe him or not believe him. Anyway, the symbolism of Changing of the Guards draws on a number of sources, including the Bible and tales of gods, demigods and heroes of ancient Greek mythology. The influence of the Romantic poets is noticeable, especially of Keats's unfinished epic Hyperion. And this is set in the symbolic landscape of the ancient Greek mythos, and it describes how the old Titanic gods are replaced by the Olympians, such as Jupiter, Neptune, and Pluto. Hyperion himself is displaced by Apollo, who puts particular value on music and poetry. And we're going to meet Apollo again later. Writing at the height of the Industrial Revolution, Keats uses this symbolic framework to state his belief that the power of the human imagination will triumph over the old superstitions. The sun god's ascension to his new throne is overseen by the Titan Mnemosyne, the mother of muses, who in 2020's Rough and Rowdy Ways, Dylan will later announce his devotion to. There had been hints of Dylan's interest in ancient mythology on the previous album, Desire, on which Isis, another dreamlike epic, features a personification of his lover as an Egyptian goddess. In Sarah, his song of despairing but hopeless devotion to his wife, which concludes the album, she is described as a glamorous nymph with an arrow and bow, so identifying her with Artemis, the Greek goddess of hunting and protector of women. The song also demonstrates the fascination which Dylan had recently developed for the powerful imagery of the tarot, which is also apparent on the other songs on Street Legal, such as No Time to Think and We Better Talk This Over. Dylan has always been fascinated by the random qualities of playing cards, as expressed in early songs such as Rambling Gambling Willie and Blood on the Tracks' comic western fantasia Lily, Rosemary and the Jack of Hearts. The tarot has a very long history, going back to early modern times. In the late 18th century, it began to be used for purposes of divination. It has gained much popularity in the modern era among followers of the New Age and hippie movements who are seeking for alternative forms of spirituality. The use of the cards is often misunderstood as a crude form of fortune telling. In fact, modern users of the tarot, of which Sarah Dillon was certainly one, will lay out the cards in a random sequence, sometimes following a set pattern and sometimes a pattern of the individual's own choosing, and meditate on both the symbolic meaning of the images and the connection between them that has been established by how they are laid out. The images themselves present archetypal mortal and immortal figures which symbolise the whole range of situations that an individual may find him or herself in. By recognising these archetypal patterns which the images represent, the acolyte can then confront certain psychological patterns that may lie buried within their own psyches. Carl Jung believed that the cards might provide ways to unlock the secrets of the unconscious mind. In a 1933 lecture, he stated that man always felt the need of finding an access through the unconscious to the meaning of an actual condition, because there is a sort of correspondence or a likeness between the prevailing condition and the condition of the collective unconscious. One of the main purposes that a modern tarot reader may use the cards for is to confront issues of change. The ancient Chinese text I Ching is often used for similar purposes. Dylan's interest in this area is indicated in the early New York version of Idiot Wind from Blood on the Tracks, where he actually describes having thrown the coins used for this book of divination. Having been through the life-changing experience of divorce in subsequent years, he now seems to be searching for ways to adapt to changes in his life. Here, it is as if he has laid out a spread of tarot cards and has constructed a symbolic story told through the images presented to him. The title of the song does not refer to the tarot, however, although it sounds like it might, doesn't it? But to a popular metaphorical saying based on the famous ceremony which tourists flock to see within the gates of Buckingham Palace. The idea of changing of the guards implies a deep and complete change of situation or of mental attitudes. And I guess you can almost imagine that as a tarot card with the two guards perhaps facing each other. The song has 9 verses. Everyone begins with a short statement, followed by 4 lines in irregular metre. The rhyme scheme is also somewhat irregular. The 3rd and 5th lines mostly rhyme, but the 2nd and 4th lines only rhyme in 5 of the verses. The effect of this is to force the listener to focus on the rich lyricism of the song and the rather extraordinary twists and turns that the lyrics take. The opening 16 years has been taken to represent the amount of time Dylan has been operating as a recording artist. It is also roughly the time between the composition of Hard Rain and Changing of the Guards. Perhaps that's more significant. Thus, the song may be taken to be, on one level, a kind of self-portrait, tracing Dylan's personal history throughout his career. The following 16 banners united over the field appears to place us on a medieval battlefield. We hear that the Good Shepherd grieves over the fact that these desperate men and women are divided. There is an obvious reference to Jesus here, which, along with the other biblical references, some have seen as a prelude to the religious conversion which Dylan would experience at the end of the year. But here, the Good Shepherd appears to have no real power to halt the carnage, and will play no further role in what follows. He merely hovers over the scene like a figure in a medieval painting. The next 5 verses of the song are presented as a dream narrative, in which a series of highly resonant images flash before the narrator's eyes. Many of these come from the tarot, as if the narrator is laying out a series of cards and then placing himself inside the images, which then come alive, like the playing cards in Alice's Adventures in Wonderland, or Lily, Rosemary and the Jack of Hearts. First, he draws the Wheel of Fortune. In the standard Rider-Waite version of the cards, first published in England in 1910, this card is centred on a large wheel, engraved with the letters T-O-R-A, and surrounded by the figures of a snake and 2 Egyptian gods, Typhon, who represents evil, and Anubis, who welcomes souls into the underworld. Surrounding them are winged figures representing the 4 fixed signs of the zodiac: an angel, Aquarius, an eagle, Scorpio, a lion, Leo, and a bull, Taurus. Declaring that fortune calls, the narrator steps into the marketplace, which is crammed with merchants and thieves hungry for power. But the Wheel of Fortune symbolises shifting circumstances. Even though his last deal has gone down, he knows that the wheel will eventually turn. Here, perhaps, is the young poet tentatively stepping into the commercial music business, hoping to make the world aware of what is happening on that battlefield. Perhaps, he hopes, the winged figures will protect him. The resonant phrase, "My last deal gone down," a staple of many blues songs, which Dylan later adapts for his own "When the Deal Goes Down," 2006, a meditation on mortality, may indicate that he's down on his luck. Maybe this represents the young singer blowing his harmonica for a dollar a day, as he once sang, in the icy New York winter. On another level, it may suggest that he has actually died on the battlefield and that the surreal world of shifting images he has entered is some form of afterlife. He's with the gods, perhaps, on Olympus. The narrator immediately encounters the woman who he will pursue throughout the song in his own heroic quest. She seems at first to be representative of all that is good and natural. Like the female figures in so many of Dylan's visionary songs, she may well represent his poetic muse. She is certainly elusive, a shapeshifter who continually changes form as the visions pile up. The narrator is entranced by her scent and her beauty, and transfixed by her elusiveness. It is suggested that she may be a kind of earth goddess. "She's smelling sweet," he tells us, already going into an erotic reverie, like the meadows where she was born. Then we're on to the next card. We hear that her birth has occurred in difficult circumstances, on Midsummer's Eve, near the tower. The tower card portrays disaster. It seems to have been struck by lightning, and people are desperately jumping out of the windows. Midsummer's Eve, like Halloween, is traditionally thought to be a time in which witches and other spirits are active. The implication is that the woman is the spawn of supernatural forces. But he is inexorably drawn to her, despite the obvious danger that she represents. She may smell seductively sweet, but she is notoriously capable of driving her lovers into states of delirium, while she remains impassive. In the next line, we hear that she is standing under the cold-blooded moon. The moon card depicts a full yellow moon with an angry face, with two wolves baying beneath her. The figure of the moon in the tarot represents illusion and deception. It seems that this spirit woman may be leading him towards an uncertain fate, but the next card, the captain, which we might identify with the narrator, represents something more optimistic. He is confident that his love will soon be repaid. He confesses his love for this beloved maid whose ebony face is beyond communication. Perhaps she is another manifestation of Isis, the Egyptian moon goddess. As the song gathers pace, we are presented with more and more outlandish, vivid imagery, much of which is tarot-related. In the next verse, we hear that the woman's head is shaved, suggesting that she's been captured and is about to be tortured or killed as a witch. We are told that she is torn between Jupiter and Apollo, two Olympian gods. In some tarot packs, Jupiter is the name given to a figure called the Hierophant, a teacher and dispenser of wisdom who is often associated with the Wheel of Fortune. The sun god, Apollo, is associated with both music and better times ahead. Perhaps the young poet is similarly torn, not sure whether to pursue a life of intellectual vigour or one of potentially destructive hedonism. Or perhaps whoever is between these two forces will be torn apart. Thus, in his dreamlike state, the narrator identifies himself with the sun and the elusive female as the moon. In reality, of course, the sun will never catch the moon. Both must coexist in order for the cosmos to remain stable. The poet must forever chase his muse across the firmament. She will always be slightly out of his reach. In one of the song's most memorable images, we are told that a messenger arrived with a black nightingale. A beautifully succinct and highly suggestive line. Nightingales have featured in the entire history of literature and song as far back as Homer. In more recent years, they became staples of romantic songs. Generally, they've come to symbolise purity and goodness. The romantic poets associated them with creativity and nature. In Keats's opium dream, Ode to a Nightingale, the bird represents the spirit that will fly out of him after his imminent death. The narrator's own journey is becoming rather similar to that of Keats. As if of hemlock he had drunk. A nightingale is normally a sign of hope, but here the black nightingale is ambiguous. Perhaps this mysterious goddess has manifested herself in this spectral form. The narrator declares that he is inexorably drawn to follow her down past the fountain where they lifted her veil. But this time, we are not given a glimpse of her ebony face. In the next verse, we are jolted back to the battlefield where the song began. I stumbled to my feet, the narrator tells us. I rode past destruction in the ditches, with the stitches still mending neath a heart-shaped tattoo. In the Rider Tarot, the Three of Swords depicts a heart being pierced simultaneously by three swords. Perhaps this is the tattoo he carries as a sign of devotion to his dream woman. He's still wounded from his exploits in the battle. The image of the Three of Swords represents the pain that the words and actions of another can inflict on the heart. This is followed by another extraordinary image in which renegade priests and treacherous young witches are handing out the flowers that are given to you. These corrupt figures are seen here mocking his expression of love for her. The poet's pursuit of his muse has been subverted by his followers, some who ascribe spiritual meaning to his work, and others who wish to exploit him sexually in order to gain access to his wealth and fame. The sixth verse presents perhaps the most remarkable dream vision in the entire song. We now begin to move away from the tarot imagery as the narrator begins to perceive his surroundings with a kind of hallucinatory intensity. We are now in a vast palace of mirrors, a fantastical building perhaps in which an individual's every movement is mirrored in a thousand different shifting reflections. Perhaps we are in the Hall of Mirrors in the Palace of Versailles, where the notorious Treaty of Versailles was signed at the end of the First World War. The treatment of Germany in this treaty was so harsh and punitive that it led to a collapse in the German economy, and some would argue the later rise of Hitler. This is a place where dog soldiers are reflected. The dog soldiers were a band of Cheyenne warriors who carried out a hopeless fight against their white conquerors in the mid-19th century. Thus we are presented with images of the bitter futility of human conflict, depicted here as an endless road. The rather surreal image of the wailing of chimes suggests the lamentations of those who have lost loved ones in wars, amplified by the ringing of church bells, echoing Dylan's own late protest lament, Chimes of Freedom. We are led into the empty rooms where her memory is protected. Here we hear the voices of angels whispering to the souls of previous times, as if the invisible angels are saying prayers for the many dead who have fallen prematurely in war throughout the ages. To say this is a haunting line would be an understatement. The first abrupt line of the seventh verse, "She wakes him up," jolts us out of this fantastical dream. It is 2 days later and the sun is breaking. To signify this sudden change, we switch pronouns. This is reminiscent of the shifting pronouns in Dylan's great Cubist song about a doomed relationship tangled up in blue, in which the constant changing of narrative perspectives takes us in and out of intimate contact with the subjects of the song. The sun is described not as rising but breaking, as if the sky or the cosmos itself is breaking open. In Chimes of Freedom we heard that the sky cracked its poems in naked wonder. Now we appear to be on a mountainside, but not one he can, like the blue-eyed boy of Hard Rain, preach from. In the next line we are almost literally bombarded by a series of images from Greek mythology. Broken chains, mountain laurels and rolling rocks. Showing us first Prometheus Unbound, the figure who steals fire from the gods and gives it to man, and who is then chained to rocks for all eternity. Shelley's play Prometheus Unbound depicts the bringer of fire as escaping from his chains, which symbolises humanity breaking free from the religious and social dogmas of the past, through the power of the poetic imagination. The mountain laurel is a tree that grows in the USA, but in Greek mythology the laurel has a prominent place. In a story that was considerably embellished by the Roman poet Ovid in his Metamorphoses, the nymph Daphne, who is dedicated to preserving her chastity, is pursued by Apollo with great fervour. Eventually, in his frustration, he turns her into a laurel tree. Feeling rather guilty about this, he swears to protect laurel trees, which as a result are evergreen. Laurel trees and wreaths were presented as prizes to military and artistic heroes, which is where the term poet laureate came from. Rolling rocks appears to refer to the myth of Sisyphus, an errant king who the gods punished by forcing him to roll the huge boulder up a hill for all eternity. But he could never get the stone to the top, as it would always roll back down. Thus, as he is woken up, the narrator is presented with a number of mythical scenarios. Prometheus, Daphne and Sisyphus. Three figures who represent different forms of psychological entrapment are all imprisoned for eternity in their punishment. Jung argued that the Prometheus myth symbolised the danger of the human ego being separated from the collective unconscious, a problem which is solved when Prometheus is freed by the hero Hercules. In Dylan's film Rinaldo and Clara, also released in 1978, the pinball-playing Greek chorus figure David Blue refers to The Myth of Sisyphus, a 1942 essay by the French existentialist novelist Albert Camus, in which Camus argues that a myth which is normally taken to represent the futility of repeating a failed method can be seen as positive. As the stone rolls down the hill, Sisyphus has no choice but to accept his fate by distancing himself from it psychologically. Therefore, melancholy is turned into joy. Such a transformation is now about to take place. The myth of Apollo and Daphne is often seen as a battle between chastity and lust, or between emotions being blocked and frustrated. It now seems that in the dream section of the song, which is the first six verses, the protagonist may well be Apollo, and Daphne may be the elusive figure he has been unsuccessfully chasing. But now he has woken from his dream, and everything is about to change. We now switch into the continuous present tense, as if this is a film script. We hear that Daphne, if this indeed is her, demanding that our protagonist should take dramatic action to change the world. His response is portrayed in the brilliantly cinematic image of he's pulling her down and she's clutching onto his long golden locks. Here, Daphne willingly surrenders her virginity, pulling on his angelic blonde hair in her ecstasy. The union of the two, so long desired by our hero Apollo, gives him great fulfillment and the determination to summon up the courage to demand changes that he, as the most powerful of the gods, actually has the power to bring about. This is the bit, of course, where the band should really rock out and where the guitarist has full rein to knock off a fluid solo. The big bang, so to speak. The last two verses consist of a highly rhetorical speech which our Apollonian hero presents to the other gods. In a bizarre twist, he addresses them formally as if they are a group of businessmen, politicians, or even mafia bosses, while delivering an unequivocal offer to them which they would be very unwise to refuse. "Gentlemen," he said, "I don't need your organisation," he tells them sarcastically, piling on the alliteration. "I've shined your shoes, I've moved your mountains, I've marked your cards." Now his tone could be seen as threatening. He clearly no longer needs to defer to them. Then he makes a crucial statement. He tells us that Eden is burning, and then, still talking at first like a gangster, delivers the clear threat, "Either brace yourself for elimination." Then we get the coup de grace, "Or else your hearts must have the courage for the changing of the guards." He's fully awake now, having awoken from his dream, and is now addressing those who wield power in the world. He demonstrates that, unless they change their ways, the apocalyptic destruction of the paradise of the earth may be at hand. The final verse, with its quite magnificent and dexterous use of dramatic and visionary language, appears to complete the speech. "Peace will come," the narrator states, now assuming a prophetic role, "with tranquility and splendour on wheels of fire." There is a passing reference here to the prophet Ezekiel's vision of heavenly spiritual transcendence. The allusion may also be to one of King Lear's final speeches, in which he declares his submission to fate. "I am bound upon a wheel of fire that mine own tears do scald like molten lead." Both interpretations may be valid here. It seems that the narrator has now assumed Apollo's godlike powers and is telling the gentleman that a new millennial age is on the horizon. He appears to be sweeping away all the centuries of war and declaring peace for all eternity to come. But this vision is immediately undercut. It seems that the figure of peace is another mythic personification, perhaps of the goddess Irene, a beautiful woman who carries a scepter, another manifestation of the muse the narrator has been following. We hear that she will offer no reward as her false idols fall. The narrator seems to be inferring, perhaps in a threatening way, that the gentleman can expect no special treatment when peace arrives. The song's final image is perhaps the most resonant of all, and cruel death surrenders with its pale ghost retreating between the king and the queen of swords. here we are clearly back in the symbolic realm of the tarot. Both the King and Queen of Swords represent rationality and fair judgment. Thus, the image of cruel death retreating between these two figures is a remarkable one. It suggests that, having finally consummated his love for his muse, the poet may have achieved a kind of immortality. On a more universal level, the image may represent the ultimate triumph of peace over war. But the much-feared death card in the tarot is often misunderstood. It may signify destruction, but it is actually more likely to indicate the death of old ways and the opening up of new possibilities, the changing of the guards. Thus, the certainty of change may be being celebrated here, or those changes will merely fade away when confronted with the rulers of rationality. A new era of spiritual fulfilment may be about to dawn, or a new era of crushing materialism. The tarot cards do not predict the future. They merely lay out the possibilities, presenting us with archetypal images that can be read in many different ways. Thus, the ultimate message of the song seems to be that a poet, or any one of us, needs throughout his or her life to learn to confront the forces of love, death, innocence, evil, justice, and betrayal. We will interpret the cards we draw in life in different ways, but in that interpretation lies the difference between peace and war, love and hate, success and failure. One thing is certain though, we must always be prepared to accept change in our lifestyles, in how we practice our arts, or how we relate to others. Our whole lives, as we go through the seven ages of man, are a process of metamorphosis. In order to keep progressing, we need to be strong and fearless. Our hearts must have the courage, indeed, for the changing of the guards. Okay, it's quite a long one this week. I hope you enjoyed that. You can check me out. You can give some responses on my website, which is chrisgregory.org. And you can see a text of this article, which is kind of almost the same as what I've said, but maybe a little bit different. And if you want to make some comments, you please do. Any feedback is always gratefully accepted. So that's about it for today, and see you next time.